chilly in here too.
It's chilly in here, mm-hmm. but the conversation's going to be hot. So I'm sitting here with D-May. Hello.
Okay. I corrected you right off
I'm
the bat.
I'm sitting here with D-May Roberts.
And we've known each other how many years?
Oh, okay, before
Since
my oldest
early
daughter.
90s, right?
Yeah, because yeah. Kate was born in 93.
You're one of the few people that remember that I acted.
Right, because we both
Portland.
Played men.
In Tiger's Heart.
In Tiger's Heart.
Shakespeare Company.
Which was...
Yeah, that was awesome.
Fantastic.
You got more roles as a smaller... This was interesting about Shakespeare. You get more roles as a smaller, smaller roles as
mm-hmm.
male,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to playing Lady Macbeth.
Right.
You do.
Right.
You get more lines.
Right.
Playing, you know, Hortensio and Taming of the Shrew.
And you get to climb, and you get to sword fight. Which is
the
good.
Sword fighting was good.
It was really good. And remember,
I really loved the sword fighting.
We did,
yes.
Let's see, it was Henry Part 4.
You did that. I didn't do that, but you were awesome in that.
Dang it.
Yeah.
I thought you did that. Well,
no.
We got to get those lessons where we got to climb.
No, that was scary.
The winning
yeah.
stab
yeah,
with
yeah.
the climbing equipment. And
yeah.
It was fantastic.
Yeah. That was more athletic. I just waved a sword around, you know, in Taming of the Shrew.
But
That's
you look
pretty
good
much,
doing it.
It was fun. So anyway, we go way back.
Yeah, so this is not what we really came to talk about. But that said, I was so lucky. I think I was trawling on the old Facebook, which sometimes has merits. And I saw that D-May was going to be on this podcast called the Mixed Race Podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it was that another actress had told me that it was a terrific podcast. So
oh,
of
nice.
Course I listened to
wow.
it.
And that's good to hear.
Oh, I mean, I watch what you do, and I listen to what you do, and you're on KBOO.
Stage and Studio.
Yeah.
And I've had you on that show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And plus, your playwriting, your book writing, kind of feeling as though I know somehow your relationship with you and your mom, because it's
yeah,
been...
Yeah, on my radio documentaries, too.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah. And I think you came to Breaking Glass when I did that play.
Yes.
At Portland Rep.
And
yeah.
And I'm so... Now, in awe sounds crazy. You're sitting right here. I'm touching you, like being in awe. But the tenacity, the courage you've had in the work you've done and the perseverance and knowing what that means to have a career over this time span and achieve as much as you have.
And especially as a woman.
Yes.
You know, in all these different artistic marketplaces, it's all the same, which is challenging.
It's very challenging. Yeah. And it's very challenging. And to keep, you know, your heart up... You know, to write a book, the Letting Go trilogies, which D-May is going to read a little bit from, but, you know, tell us a little bit about your process, what the book's about, how you've come to it. I mean, it's fascinating.
Well, I've done a lot of personal writing mm-hmm. through my stage plays in the 90s, but then I also have done a lot of radio documentaries that were personal.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started working... as a columnist at the Asian Reporter, and I'm writing more, you know, personal essays through that. And through the last 10 years or so, I've collected a sizable collection of personal essays through Oregon Humanities and some book anthologies that I've been in, and the Asian Reporter. And I thought, well, you know, and then also the documentary. So I thought, well, why don't I put them all together in one collection? And that was my intention. And so I applied for a RAC grant, a Regional Arts and Culture Council grant, and I got it. And so that allowed me to hire editors who could help me shape it. And they were so challenging. It's like, well, don't just put together a collection of essays. Actually make it more, have a through line, you know, make it more of a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I attempted to do. But the bulk of them have been published elsewhere. And it was excruciating to do this because I had to rewrite what I already thought was written. So it took more time, obviously. And then I opted to go towards create space and publish it on my own. And that was also challenging, too, to see it from the side of a publisher and work with formatting and having, formatting, editing, and that kind of thing done. So it was a painstaking process. When you write a short piece or do a short radio piece, you don't have to worry about things like repetitive words that
right.
you use.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of get away with it after 1,000 or 2,000 words. It comes back again in a book, and you go, oh, I'm repetitious. Whereas
right.
in a short essay, that's not even an issue.
It's so interesting you should say that, because I listened to that podcast, The New Yorker, where they read the short stories.
Right,
like famous
right,
author
right.
reads another author's short story. And you come into a place where you recognize certain authors'
style,
vocabulary.
Yeah.
You know, you hear a certain word. It's, oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, you do increase your vocabulary and you're, you know, you get more creative with your word usage when you have to write a book.
Right.
So it was an incredible learning experience. It was hard. Mm-hmm. And some people, you know, I've never had a baby, but some people, you know, say it's like birthing a baby. I'll have to take your word for it because you have more experience in that than I do.
Yeah.
But it's difficult. I mean,
right.
people feel that way about plays. Mm-hmm. You know, people feel that way about making a film. Mm-hmm. You know, it is. You're really...
Discipline and more discipline.
And, you know, there's a whole gestation period. And then when you get it out there, that's what it is. It's like, you're not going to change the baby. That's the baby.
That's so
right?
crazy. Because, I mean, I know even when I write something on my blog, for instance, which I wax and wane on, I go back in time and I think, well, that's ridiculous. I don't like that. And then it, do you, I mean, that I could, A, I could take it off.
You could change it.
But there's a real book I'm looking at on this table, and that's that's the way it is.
So it is. I mean, I could go back and redo it, but I'm more like, well, that's what I did, and
this
I'm going to
now.
Move on to the next project.
Right, and that's what you've done your whole career.
Yeah, I really have, and that's, I think, what tires me the most. You know, it's like one project after another. But there's always something interesting to do, Susanna.
I know, and I, you know? I love the title of your book, because I think as I get older, letting go, it's... kind of what we're talking about, even surrendering to what is and moving on to the next thing, letting things move through you.
I think it's a survival mechanism too, because if you don't let go of things, it will eat at you,
right.
and it ends up being destructive.
Right.
And it's taken me all these years to figure that out, and I'm still figuring it out.
I know, me too.
And I joke that, you know, be careful what you write as the title of your book or the title of your play, because it'll come back to you. So
right.
it's the Letting Go trilogies, and so I get, well, Dime, have you let that go yet? You know, it's like, or if I get a little upset about it, like, oh, let it go, Dime.
Right.
You know, let it go.
Right. This
you know, you wrote this book.
Right now.
I know. And actually, it's good, because I have to say it to myself. I better not get upset about this, or, you know, say that, because I have to be, you know, more together. So I'm letting that go.
Oh, what's the funny thing about letting go is that, I mean, I know that I'm in the same place in my life, but you decide you're going to let go, and then you're like, I let that go, and then it comes back next week, and you're like, I didn't let that go.
No, it comes back sometimes.
Yeah, that must be where our trilogies is in there.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I sense three.
Well, there's three sets of essays.
Mm-hmm.
About different topics. So it's about my family. Mm-hmm. You know, my family's our characters in this. And it's also about my relationship to my, you know, ethnicity and identity, mm-hmm. being biracial Asian American. And it's also about going back to Taiwan three times,
right.
you know, for three different decades,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so all of that, I found that there was a collection of three, so I put that together. So it's sort of an unusual take on the idea of trilogies. I'm not going to write another letting go book.
Right, but it's how
letting I'm
go.
Letting that go.
So you've done so many fascinating things in your art, you know, whether it's radio, movies, or I guess film making.
Short films.
Books, plays. You're going to write another book, or what are you thinking for next?
Yeah, I am. It's going to be a novel, and I'm about halfway through it. So I you know, I'll see when I have time. I'm hoping for next year, to have
great.
More time. Because right now I'm trying to concentrate on building this archive of 300 hours of Asian American oral histories that I gathered for this project that I did called Crossing East 10 years ago.
Mm.
And that was 8 hours of Asian American history, and we gathered about 300 hours worth of audio. So I'm trying to build a repository that's downloadable, and it has transcripts, and future generations can use it, and it will be a good resource for educators.
How did you go about doing that, or what inspired you to do that, or who did you do it for?
Oh, well, it was for NPR originally, but then I switched to PRI. But basically, it was, you know, it aired on about 230 NPR stations.
Oh, gee whiz, I have to look for that. I don't think I've heard
that. Well, it's, and I'm going to put all the 8-hour episodes online, too.
Oh, that's great.
But yeah, that was in 2006, and it was a 3-year project, and I raised a huge amount of money for it. And basically, I did it because nobody else did.
Right.
And a lot of times I do that because nobody else is doing it.
Did you travel across the country when you were
born? Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I also hired a lot of people, about 50 scholars and producers and writers. And I had actors doing reenactments and musicians creating music. So it was a huge project. But we gathered a lot of audio. And I want to put it all online. That's so that's what I'm trying to do and get that done by May of next year.
So here's a question that comes to mind right away, and that is, now you were interviewing people all across the country about their experience as of being an Asian American in contemporary society.
No, history. It historical. Went from pre-America, like the land bridge, you know, crossing over from Asia to Pacific America, Pacific Northwest history of Hawaiians settling in the Pacific Northwest. There are towns called Aloha, and the Owyhee River. I mean, there was a huge history of Hawaiians intermarrying Native Americans.
Oh, interesting.
Kalama, Washington being a prime example of that. So we did that. Mm-hmm. You know, Kalama is a Hawaiian name.
I didn't know that.
So we started there and then went all the way to post 9/11 with Japanese Americans who were formerly interned coming in support of South Asians who were being racially profiled and discriminated against after 9/11. So the Japanese Americans who were former internees were the first ones to speak up against racial profiling and the possibility of I guess deporting as well as rounding up. I mean, there was talk about rounding up a whole new set of people, you know, at that time. So, and it's still, there's still talk about it now. So that's where we ended, because I started working on this in 2003. And so that's a complete Pan-Asian history up until post 9/11.
That's out of this world.
Yeah, well, it hadn't been done.
Right.
You know. So the idea is to organize all of the oral history so that we couldn't air, you know, like even a third of what we got.
Oh, my goodness.
So there you go.
I've actually thought about this a lot, and you as an actress as well. I mean, all the work you've done and all the work that you've done that's not been what you've written plays in existence about how they lay out, you know, in history and what they say about our time and the time when they were written and how young people can learn even from reading so many plays about the time, the plays. It's so fascinating.
I mean, even plays from the 90s are a record of time period.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking in terms of theater diaspora. I started this Asian American theater company with five other people and we, you know, are producing Che Yu's A Language of Their Own, which was written in the 90s about the HIV/AIDS crisis, told from the perspective of these two Asian American men who are couples, and then this other white man and Asian American who is also a couple. So, I mean, you know, they're interesting perspectives from that perspective, you know, from that time period. And it's a document of that time period, because I think people now don't really think of AIDS as that, you know, like it's over.
Right, it's and it America isn't. America too, you know, you look at the plays like that and you realize, you think, okay, that
is a huge document
of our time. Oh, it's so great. I mean, the work you do is very inspiring. And I know, you know, on stage and studio, you're constantly interviewing artists. And I mean, I would think, and I know from the little I've done with this podcast over a short span of time, nowhere near what you've amassed over at KBOO, that it's very inspiring to talk to artists and hear what they're doing and see why they're doing it.
Well, I think it is important, and it keeps you connected with people too that you don't get to see very often, or meet new people, you know. I think that it is inspiring to hear people doing work, because most of it is a labor of love. I mean, even if you're paid for it, you're still not, you know, you're not really compensated,
well,
you know, as much.
All
you know,
the people that are going to hear your piece on and PRI now it's called, right? Public Radio International.
Oh, well, yeah, if it was, yeah.
Things like that that'll be out in the world that will, you know, you say it's never been done. Well, you don't even think a certain way until your mind's been blown. You think, wow, somebody just decided to do that. You decided to do that and tell a story that hasn't been told. And that's, I think, where we're at.
I think that's what artists have to do. I generally get an idea and I try to raise funds for it and then try to implement it. You know, and I think that's what theater people do. I think that's what dancers do. I think that's what visual artists do.
Right.
You know, some of them don't get funding and they go ahead and do it anyway. And that's the other choice. And then hopefully you'll get paid for it later.
Right.
You know,
somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. Somehow.
Well, I know you're going to read a little bit from the book. Would you like to do that?
Sure.
Now?
I'm having a reading September 1st.
Wonderful.
When I threw a plug there for it's at another Read Through bookstore, which is on Mississippi Avenue. I don't have the exact address.
Great. I'll put it on the podcast.
Thank you.
On the bottom.
Yeah. So that's going to be September 1st at 7 p.m.
Great.
But I'm also tailoring to talk about mixed race, too, and maybe get some people in the audience to tell their mixed race story.
Oh,
you know?
That's fantastic.
So anybody who wants to come and hear some interesting stories, not just from me, but from other people. So the book, I deal a lot with my family, and one of the tragedies for my family was moving to Junction City, Oregon. After being in Asia, I was born in Taiwan. We lived in Japan till I was about 8, and then we moved around. My dad was from Oklahoma, and my mom was from Taiwan, and I feel like my dad was probably trying to find a place other than Oklahoma to take us, but he also loved being in the country. I don't think he wanted to move us back to Oklahoma because of the racism there. He was from Tahlequah, which is the heart of the Trail of Tears, you know, where a lot of the Cherokee, I don't mean to laugh, it was a horrible time period for the Cherokees who had to come over. But that was the background. And so I think he was trying to find a place that would allowed him to have the what he thought was an idyllic life in the country. And we ended up being in Junction City, which is half an hour outside of Eugene, and we were the only interracial family there, and it was pretty much the downfall for my brother, who looked Chinese, and I ended up, you know, calling myself Secret Asian Girl because I could pass. So I'm going to read a little bit about that. What actually got my brother and I through a lot was our love of Star Trek, you know, and that kind of thing that, you know, had multiracial people in it. And we could kind of, you know, live outside of what our reality was by just investing in science fiction. So I'm going to read a little bit from that. So this is from the Letting Go trilogy, Stories of a Mixed Race Family. Jack and I had bonded over watching science fiction television shows. At the same time, Jack became the target of racial jokes and taunting from school kids who had never seen Asian people before. On our first day of school in Junction City, my brother and I rode home on the school bus. That experience would shape my brother's downfall. We had moved to a town with a population smaller than the audience of an outdoor rock concert, and I knew what it meant to be outsiders. It remains emblazoned in my memory as a reminder of how quickly people can turn on you because they thought you were white and discover it wasn't quite true. On that first day, my beautiful porcelain-skinned mother, 99 pounds petite with a coiffed black Brigitte Bardot bouffant, wanted to make sure we were safe afterward. As the school bus neared our house, all the kids could see her standing there on the side of the highway waiting for us to come home. A wave of gasps rippled from the front to the back of the bus where we were sitting. They're Chinese. All eyes locked on my younger brother and me as we made our way down the aisle of the bus. As I stepped down, I didn't greet my mother with a smile or a thank you. I secretly wished she had stayed away, stayed hidden, so we could have been spared the humiliation of being Chinese. Junction City was filled with 2,000 or so descendants of mostly Scandinavian farmers and pioneers. Many had journeyed from the Midwest to Oregon to start new lives. Every street and lane was named for early Scandinavian descendants. The most noted was Dane Lane, built by a real estate developer in 1902. He bought Danish ads in Midwestern papers calling for families of Danish descent to start a colony in Junction City. Several generations later, we were their first interracial family. The school system in this town became an uncapped well of torment for my brother. From the first day on the bus, my sweet, sensitive Jack endured fights and racial pranks that would now be called hate crimes. I don't know the full extent of what my brother went through. He still refuses to talk about it. Years later, I asked one of his schoolmates if they knew what had happened to him. He witnessed Jack being humiliated in the cafeteria once when bullies called him chink, nip, and jap and smeared food all over his face as kids laughed. In fourth grade, he came home without his school books. He told Daddy he needed to buy more. After we moved to Junction City, he made less eye contact. His head turned downward where once his chin lifted up full into the sun. Jack's eyes remained downcast as he spoke to Daddy. He mumbled something about boys who stole his books and tried to flush them down the toilet to the bathroom. "They called me slant eyes," he barely whispered. There were times during junior high he'd come home with bruises on his face, and Daddy would, in his good old boy naivete, try to instruct him to fight back. Jack kept his torment private from us until he graduated from high school. He only now tells me bits and pieces of his childhood, like the time in high school when the lead bully cornered him on the football field and punched him in the stomach until Jack doubled over in pain and fell to his knees. No words were spoken, only a fist communicated the hatred the boy felt for Jack for no other reason than he was marked as an Oriental. It was beyond what people would call normal bullying because it was based on race. They bullied Jack because he was some Chinese kid who lived with the only interracial family the town had ever seen. And the school turned a blind eye, relegating the hatred he experienced, chalking it up to a boys will be boys attitude. I often wondered how the bullies would have responded to a black family moving into town. Given Oregon's history of exclusion laws for African Americans, I can only think their racism would have been more severe. Oregon paradoxically passed an act in 1844 to prohibit slavery while at the same time excluding blacks and mulattoes. That's quotation marks there. The same act required, quotation mark, blacks in Oregon, be they free or slave, to be whipped twice a year until he or she quit the territory, unquote. Later, whipping was deemed too harsh, so it was reduced to forced labor. Interracial marriages were banned in 1866 between anyone who was more than one quarter Chinese or Hawaiian or more than half Native American. It was previously illegal for whites and blacks to marry. The 1882 Exclusion Act passed by the U.S. Congress barred immigration of Chinese laborers to the U.S. Chinese workers who had laid railroad tracks across America were allowed to stay, but this law opened floodgates for anti-Chinese violence, and including mobs of people chasing out the Chinese in Oregon City and Portland. Though my brother physically survived the nightmare of violence he endured, he has never recovered emotionally. After I came back from my second year of college, I found Jack trying on his graduation robe. Ma insisted he walk down the high school track like I did when I graduated. The ceremony required male and female friends or partners to walk together. I had asked a male friend. Jack had no friends. He would have had to walk alone. My graduation had been a proud moment for my parents and one of the only times they met my friends. But I could tell Jack was scared for his life. I felt the weight of his fear press into my heart. "You know," I said quietly to him when my parents left the room, "you don't have to go. They'll still give you your diploma." "I don't?" I smiled back at him. "Nope." I convinced my parents to release him from the ordeal he dreaded. I suspected the bullies had threatened to have some fun with him after the graduation ceremony. We ended up taking photos of him in his blue and gold graduation cap and gown, the colors of the JC Tigers, in the front yard as cars and log trucks whooshed by. I rolled up a piece of paper and tied a red ribbon on it in place of the diploma he'd get in the mail later on. And he looked directly at me, his big sister, with a rare display of gratitude in his eyes.
It's so poignant. And I heard you read this excerpt on the Mixed Race podcast, and I was just as moved this time hearing it. That level of cruelty is...
Racism to me is not like an issue. It is personal, yes. You know? And I think anybody who goes through it, be it on you personally or a loved one, it's personal.
Yes.
You know, it is something that cuts deep and it affects you for the rest of your life. And I don't think that there's any kind of cure to it. It will always stay with you once you've experienced it.
It's interesting because I've been, you know, thinking about it, as I hope many people in our country are thinking about it, about how we're going to do things differently. And it reminds, the only thing I can kind of equate it with, I mean, since I'm Jewish, you know, I certainly have a history of, not a, necessarily a personal history that I can think of this moment, but a historical racism or, you know.
There's been systematic racism and persecution, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And is,
I mean, you know,
right.
Huge persecution, right.
Yeah, is the only thing I can think about that is, gets me in that place of is grief, is to, because reading about what happened to your brother and not knowing now how he is or where he is or what he's doing in his life, is that loss of innocence for him, that taking away of the possibility of a life that's rich and untainted by that kind of hatred and cruelty, it's something you never get back.
I don't know how many people can experience life without that anymore, though, you know?
Well, isn't it? It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking. And, you know, the news, of course, there's so many people who are, I mean, it's coming out more and more. And
I just think it's more visible now, and people are calling it out more.
Right.
I think it's always been around.
Right. And there's more protection for people who call it out.
Maybe.
I hope.
Maybe. Yeah.
Hmm. What has happened to your brother?
Well, I write about that in my book, too. He was so affected by it that he has never really recovered from it.
Oh.
So he's still very introverted and would rather be a hermit. And I think he has a huge distrust of people and strangers especially.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that, he's never recovered from it at all. And so it had that kind of an impact on him,
which
you know.
I don't.
And I think that if we had lived in an urban area or even Eugene, you know,
right.
something that was a little bit more of a town, I think that you would have found other people. When you live in isolation and experience this, I think it's even more pronounced because you don't have any kind of support network.
Right. And he had you.
Yeah, but I was dealing with my own stuff,
right.
you know,
and
so
at that age,
and I was also, you know, he was held back a couple of years too, so I wasn't in school at the same time as he was. So he had a lot of learning disabilities too, on top of that. So yeah, so he's a tragic figure. I mean, in some ways, I think every single member of my family has had a tragic, you know, lifetime. Yeah. But you know, part of what I deal with is, you know, letting go of grief as well and regret. There are a lot of things that we do as caring, sensitive people that we wish that we could have done more of.
Oh, I could not agree
and
more.
And you have to let go of that. You have to let go of the anger that you feel about the inequities of life, you know. You have to let go of your own, I guess, inability to be a super person, you know,
superhero, right.
Because I think a lot of it too is that we have to be kinder to ourselves, you know, as
well
as to other people.
And your this book being in the world, I think every time someone tells their truth, their story, it is a path for others to broaden their ability to take these things in.
I hope so.
And do
yeah.
a little bit more.
I mean, that's what I like to read. You know, I like to read things that will make me, you know, think about things and expand my, not just knowledge, but my heart,
right.
you know, as
and,
well.
And open the door for your own compassion.
Yeah.
It's
that's hard. And, you know, also, too, I have to realize that I, as somebody who, it was an oddity to be mixed race growing up at the time that I did and in the place that I did, that I have charted 4 decades as an adult, you know, of what it means to be mixed race and how that's changed through the years and how we think about it. I mean, even the term mixed race is a new term.
Yes.
You know, as opposed to I'm half this, I'm half that, you know.
This American.
Exactly. Yeah, hyphen, hyphen, hyphen. So that there has been a lot of growth as far as discovering what identity is, and it's still growing.
Right.
Yeah.
Where I think there's a lot, we've got miles to go before we sleep, of course, but there's this difficulty in communicating about these things among people, mixed race or not. This difficulty with, you know, people want to say who they are and people want to correctly address them. Are you for, you know, Native American, African American, Black, you know.
Yeah.
And I realize.
I like to get that out of the way, though.
I like it.
And I think it's good to do that. In fact, that's part of what I want to do with, I've been chosen to be on the Oregon Humanities Conversation Project, and my topic is mixed race. You know, it's called What Are You? And it's like four decades of mixed race.
I think that's something I remember from the Mixed Race podcast, was that what are you question,
right,
which I
right.
love, because you're just asking, it's no big deal. You're talking about something. And in fact, you, in asking someone what they want to be called, either their name or how they identify,
how you want to buy it,
sexuality, religion,
right.
gender, whatever, that you're just saying, who are you? Can I know you? Because the only way to know, those are the questions.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it seems superficial, but those are deep questions.
And, you know, those are deep questions, and it isn't something that people have to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to provide a safe space where people could talk about it and talk to each other about it.
Yeah, which is,
you know,
great.
And just open up. It took a long time. It took decades for me to open up and say, I'm actually Asian American.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't feel like I owned that title
mm-hmm.
for the longest time. And you asked me, why did I do the Crossing East Asian American History series?
Mm-hmm.
I was in radio for about 10, 12 years, and I thought, well, somebody who's full Asian would do this, and
mm-hmm.
nobody did. So that's why I took it, and I just went for it. And after doing that, I realized, you know, I don't have to call myself half this or half that. I am Asian American,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just going to own that. And I say it pretty much to anybody, you know. But it took a long time for me to get to that point.
Yeah,
you know?
It's so interesting, because there's always somebody, you know, especially being Jewish, like I said, there's people who are more Jewish than,
and what does that mean?
What's that mean?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was just in Russia, as I was telling you, and it just...
And you learned a lot about your history.
Yeah, well, there was this one woman that I met on the trip, and in any given circumstance, when we were in an area together, said, there's four of us.
That's nice.
There's seven of us. And then
that's really nice,
am
though.
Am I us?
Yeah.
Us?
It's nice to be included, doesn't it?
It's just so fascinating.
Yeah. And that's the whole idea of inclusion,
mm-hmm.
what you just experienced,
mm-hmm.
to be included. A lot of times people of color don't feel included.
Right.
And if you look at, especially in theater, you know, and you look at the casts and the companies, a lot of people aren't included.
Right.
Where I think that needs to change.
Well, what's
you know?
Kind of great, and as you know, as a RAC grant recipient, you know, there are funders now who are taking...
They actually care about it now, right.
And that's so great that people are making that...
It's a priority now.
Yeah.
And it's opened up to ability and disability as well as, you know, racial, as
mm-hmm.
well as gender, as well as age,
which
you know.
Which is so
yeah.
important because, you know, who tells these stories? In the past, it's been white men. And... You know, it's fascinating to me as these things kind of unravel, the stories that we have come to take on as our history, they don't feel true anymore.
They really don't. And I look through that lens for any play now that I see or any book, if it's the same kind of story, you know, this white man's journey, coming of age, blah, blah, I don't need that anymore.
Right.
I'm done with that.
We've had it.
Or a white middle class family has angst. I've done it.
It's so exciting, I guess, because I know that knowledge gets deepened. The more we know,
the more we expand.
It deepens and expands.
And just for simple storytelling, it's just interesting to find stories that haven't been told, isn't
right.
it?
Well, you look at a crazy little time span. Who knows?
Yeah.
1901 to 1920. And then you make sure that every story you're telling, if you tell 50 stories, have a diverse look.
Because there were people alive at that time.
Right, there were
living lives.
Right, who were...
Oh, especially that time with all the immigration that was happening.
Oh, gosh,
yeah.
And it's actually interesting because I've been doing a little bit of research about music during the Civil War, for instance.
Oh, right, because you're in the Civil War, American Civil War show.
And then I learned that the largest population of Jews was in Charleston, South Carolina.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
I never knew that, and that's just a story that hasn't been told.
I know. We just went through the Olympics, right?
Right.
And then at the closing ceremony last night, they said... Oh, and so, you know, outside of Japan, Brazil has the largest population of Japanese. And I went, what? I did not know that.
See, isn't that mind-boggling?
Yeah.
And it's these types of things I almost feel as though we're living in the Alice in Wonderland right now, where we're kind of going...
We need to discover it.
Crazy looking glass, right. Where it's like, well, this is what we've been told our world is, but actually, when people like you go out in the world and find real people to tell us their story, it's like, well, wait a minute.
Or we're living them. I mean, all my stories are basically what happened to me.
Right.
You know, and I'm just one person. So we all have these stories.
Right.
And so I encourage anybody who's listening to write them down. I'm glad you're doing a blog.
Right.
Write them down.
Right.
You know, preserve them. I'm really into preserving things and documenting things that I've already done more so, or keeping the legacy stuff going. So that's why I'm doing the archive. That's why I did this book.
Mm-hmm.
And also why theater diaspora is important to me. Once I don't do this anymore, I still want there to be a theater diaspora.
Right.
So, you know, I don't want it to just be reliant on me. But for me, it's like making some kind of legacy thing happen.
It's very interesting because there's this paradox about our desire to have tangible memories. You know, and there are things like in your heart and mind that we know, we are alone, essentially, you know. But we're not.
There are communities, and that's what social media is so cool about, with all the groups, you know, that I've been able to connect with online.
And it's so much fun that so many people are able to write their stories down, and you can read. I mean, mixed media podcasts. I meet artists, and I get to learn.
I'm amazed you heard.
Well, because like I said, this is one
That's
area
awesome.
Where I can say that Facebook did something nice.
Yay!
Yeah, I mean, it's not all bad, but you know what I mean.
Oh, I love
know?
Facebook.
You know,
I do.
It's just, there are so many people out there who are telling stories that are kind of mind-blowing.
I know. And this is cool that you're highlighting my story right now.
Oh,
being able to do that,
well,
you know?
Well, it's super inspiring. And the truth is, like you say, write down your story. If you're listening to
or
this,
tell it.
Write down your story.
Yeah.
Put it out there. Compare notes. I guess, essentially, it means that we're communicating as a people. And to my mind, that's our saving grace. If we can keep communication open, maybe things will be okay.
Well, a lot of times people get upset when, you know, somebody comes up to them, especially mixed race people, and ask, what are you, right? And so my thing is, just tell them first. You can tell when somebody's looking at you quizzically.
Right.
And just come out there and just say it.
Right.
You know? Beat them to the punch.
And
you know, and
that,
own it yourself.
Yeah, and make that a part of the courage, you know, that it takes to be a person who's stating they are and how they are, you know?
And the pride in that that's involved in that.
Yeah,
you know, if they can't take it, you don't need them, right?
Right. Well, that's a perfect way to end, even though I don't really want to end.
You don't want to end. I know, it's fun talking with you.
You
it's
too.
Been a while.
Yeah, thanks so much for
thank
reading
you.
The book. It's so beautiful. And the reading is on September 1st.
Yes.
And I will put the address, name the bookstore.
Another Read Through bookstore. Uh-huh. It's on Mississippi Avenue in Portland.
Great. I'll
in
put
North
the
Portland.
Address.
And I shout out for September 10th at Portland Center Stage, 7:30 p.m. for A Language of Their Own, and September 18th at 2 p.m. at Portland Actors Conservatory. Both theaters have been so great about donating their space to theater diaspora.
Oh, that's
it's
wonderful.
A wonderful play. I hope people come to it.
Great.
It's our last show of the season.
I'll put all the dates and times in print. And thanks again for coming.
Thank you, Susanna Mars. You're awesome.
Thanks, DNA Roberts.